As my mother would say, you're all crazy. Well, welcome everyone to tonight's satsang. And I always would like to begin by quoting my guru, Baba Muktananda, who began all of his talks by saying in Hindi, Sabko bade sanmani ke saath prem se hrdik swagat. With great respect and love, I welcome you all with all my heart. And that was the cornerstone of his approach. It was simply about heart-to-heart contact. We have to first love ourselves,
yes!
And second, love others. And we have to love ourselves. Love that most unacceptable person that you carry around with you. That first, and then others. And I want to welcome everyone watching on the internet tonight. Boy, the weather's pretty bad here. We should go up and spend a little time in Queensland, shouldn't we? You all come along, we'll have a great time there. So, as you know, I always honor the great beings. To me, the greatest resource that we have, and the most unacknowledged resource that we have, are the great beings of all traditions, the one who have attained self-realization or enlightenment, satori, samadhi, nirvana, however you talk about it. And these are great beings, and they present a possibility for us, a possibility that we probably never dreamt of. Certainly I had no knowledge of it as I grew up, and then it all came together for me in early 1970 when I learned that there was this possibility and that great beings even now exist on the planet. And I made the decision, I want to meet one, I want to have a teacher who can lead me on the inner path. And that happened when I met the American yogi Ramdas at a dinner party in Chicago. And he started talking to me, and I got that knowledge from him. One of the things that he spoke about, because then we took his workshop that weekend, and one of the people that he spoke about that really arrested me was this gentleman. Well, that's not a gentleman, that's a little boy. Show the arc, we'll go back then. This is the iconic photograph of Ramana Maharshi, the great Rishi Ramana. And I think you just look at that and you can see peace and compassion and love in those eyes, can't you? And he's a great soul, and I became intrigued by his teaching of self-inquiry, atma-vichara, where he enjoined people to go within and find out who they really were. Now, this is the essential spiritual question. Who am I? Who am I? Who am I really? Really, really, really? When I separate the cultural baggage, all the things that I learned from my culture, my parents, my school, whatever it was, the television, and find out who's the essential me. And that's what he wanted people to do. And the reason was, go back to that early one, that when he was about this age, actually, this is probably when he was around 20, but at the age of 16, I've said before, I'm like the ancient mariner who has to tell his story over and over again. When I do Ramana, I have to always tell Ramana's story. Ramana's biography is the most boring biography I know, because it lasted for about 3 days, maybe a week, when he was a normal 16-year-old kid, and he fell over at his uncle's house and realized God in 20 minutes. You should be so lucky. The most extraordinary thing happened to him, and he went through an automatic inner process of who am I? And when he got to the end of who am I? And in 20 minutes, he attained the self, and he became established in the self, and never to lose it again. He thought that he was going to die. There's an account in his own words about that. He thought he was going to die, and he said, well, if I die, if the body dies, will I die? And the answer came to him, no. And he went in this quick, intuitive fashion, deep within, and discovered there was an abiding self beyond his personal self, and that's who he really was, and he was established in it. Well, he just got up from that, and he went about normal schoolboy kids. But he found himself, now he was totally transformed. He had this constant knowledge and feeling of the self with him all the time, and he started falling into meditation. One day he was sitting on his bed looking at his homework, and he's actually meditating. His brother came in and said, oh, the great yogi, why don't you go, what are you doing, you know? Why don't you go to the Himalayas and meditate? And Ramana thought, that's a really good idea. And so probably the next day, he left, never to be seen again there. He didn't go to the Himalayas, but he went to a famous mountain in South India called Arunachala. And he spent the remaining, 54 years of his life, right near that mountain, on the mountain, near the mountain. And he was like this. And the state of consciousness which he entered was so profound that he went into kind of a constant trance, and couldn't feed himself or do anything for the first couple of years that he was there. He just got to the mountain and fell into this trance. And fortunately, it wasn't South Frankston or anywhere. So people thought, this is a holy man. They didn't think, oh, this is some kind of crazy drug addict or something. So they took care of him. They force-fed him. And he'd be in this trance. They say this, his nails grew, his hair grew. Insects bit him. He didn't even notice it. He was so deeply absorbed. And then after some time, a couple of years, he came out to the relative plane. And he said, how long have I been meditating? 20 minutes? 2 years. So he came out and already he had gathered devotees while he was in the trance. And he was known as a holy man. He had not read any scriptures. That's what I find really unique about him. He was a complete naive subject. He hadn't studied scriptures or the path or anything. And they would go to him and say, and he'd say, well, I don't know anything about that. He said, read it to me. And they'd read it to him. He'd say, yeah, that's right. We read it and say, how do I attain that? So it's a great story. And so, at an early age, there he is a few years after coming there, as the young yogi, always very austere, always very kind and considerate and loving, and always radiating a peace and an energy, a beautiful energy, and always teaching the same path that he learned in those 20 minutes of inquiring, who am I? He always said that the ultimate method is self-inquiry. That's the ultimate method. What else do you have? So this is many years later. He died in 1950, so this must be probably in the late 40s. And by this time, he was world famous because an English journalist named Paul Brunton had written a book called A Search in Secret India, which was one of my favorite books when I first started on, because I loved hearing stories of going around and meeting yogis in India. So this is the archetype of it. And one of the great yogis that he met some great yogis and some not so great yogis. And you could really tell the difference in his account. And he wasn't too kind with some of the ones he didn't like. But the greatest one in the book was Ramana, and very impressive. So a lot of people read about it and came, including Somerset Maugham, the novelist, who spent some time with Ramana, and he wrote his famous book, The Razor's Edge, based on his experience there. And Ramana appears as a character in that book under a different name. But anyway, go on. What else do we have?
There's one other.
Okay, we'll look at it later. Okay, so I like to not only do Ramana's teachings, most people approach him as kind of a self-inquiry machine. But part of the charm of Ramana is his extraordinarily attractive and wonderful personality, and cute and loving and so on. So I like to balance the two. So tonight all comes from a single devotee whose name is S.S. Cohn, Suleiman Samuel Cohn. He's an Iraqi Jew. He was a qualified accountant. He came to India in 1927 in search of the key to the mystery of life. 1927. So that to me is very interesting. I went to India in search of the key to, what does it say, to the mystery of life in 1970. And in 1970 was when the big sort of movement of seekers going to India. I guess the Beatles were the most famous. I think they went in 68. So Cohn was part of, there had been a trickle up until then. The early Westerners who discovered India and would go for spiritual sustenance. And so there's a whole group of them in the 20s and the 30s and 40s. And a lot of them found their way, a few of them found their way to Ramana's ashram. And Cohn was one of the most prominent. He got, well, I'll tell you in a minute, tell you his story. He worked in Bombay for a few years before joining the Theosophical Society at Madras, where he heard of the Maharshi and read some of his books. Now, Theosophy had a very big role in Western yoga, beginning in 1875. You know about Theosophy? There's a Theosophical Society on Russell Street, isn't there?
Yeah.
And what? Say it again?
They're selling it.
That's it. Where are they going? It's kind of, I can't say anything bad, so I won't. It's mostly very elderly people, people of my age. but it was very big, and it was a forerunner, and names like Madame Blavatsky, and Colonel Alcott, and Annie Besant, these are some of the names associated. And they eventually found Krishnamurti. They were waiting for a great world teacher, and they found this kid in India, and it was became later the famous Krishnamurti. And they nominated him and said he's the world teacher. And then at a famous moment, a little later, he said, "I renounce it all, and I renounce all of the, you know, all the hoopla." But he became the world teacher in his own way. So he joined the Theosophical Society, and he got really influenced by Ramana's books, and he adopted Sri Raman Ashram as his home in 1936. So he came to India in 27, and 1936 he moved into the Ramana Ashram, where he lived the rest of his life, from 1936 to 1980 when he died. So he lies buried on the ashram campus, it says. He wrote Guru Ramana, Reflections on Talks with Sri Ramana, and Residual Reminiscences of Ramana. So the first bit is a conversation he had with Ramana. So he was a longtime resident of Ramana's ashram. So this is conversation. It says, Mr. Cohn, a resident disciple. This is April 20th, 1937, so he's been there only a year. Has been thinking for some days about a book called Nirvana, written by a prominent theosophist, in which the author claims to reach Nirvana every night after going to sleep. Don't you reach Nirvana after going to sleep? That's what it is. Sleep is Nirvana. But, Cohen had been in the Theosophical Society, so you tend to be very critical of things that you've done in the past. So I think that's what this is. This person claims to see his own master and other masters of the Theosophical Society as bright lights within the ocean of light, which is Nirvana. He asks Sri Bhagavan, they called Ramana, Sri Ramana, how that could be possible, considering the Advaitic teaching, the non-dual teaching, or the Vedantic teaching, that the Nirvanic experience is the same as that of pure consciousness of being. What's his question? Very technical. He's saying, you're saying you're in Nirvana, but you're seeing beings. But Nirvana should be just pure consciousness, formless. So he's being very intellectual. Ramana says, Nirvana is perfection. In the perfect state, there's neither subject nor object. Nothing to see, nothing to feel, nothing to know. Seeing and knowing are the functions of the mind. In Nirvana, there is nothing but the blissful, pure consciousness, I am. So the pure self, just it's a luminous consciousness and blissful and luminous. So I talk about the clear space of good feeling. So it's the clear space of good feeling times a billion. It's got the clarity of perfect light and the good feeling of bliss. So Cohen says, how then can a prominent theosophical leader who claims clairvoyance of a high order praise the author for his supposed correct and vivid description of Nirvana? And why is the TS so obsessed by the idea of service? So he's on a fault-finding mission here. And Ramana, always, as always, is very temperate and says, calm down, boy. There's good things in everything. He says, well, theosophy and kindred movements are good inasmuch as they make a man unselfish and prepare him for the highest truth. Service like prayers, mantra repetition, and even business done in God's name leads to the highest goals, self-realization. So there are many paths. Don't be so demanding. Devotee, Cohen. But after how long? And why should a man who's ready for the absolute knowledge stick to the knowledge of the relative? Ramana is, again, temperate. You know, he's being an absolutist. But Ramana says, everything happens in its own time. And that was something I had to learn when I was first practicing yoga, because I wanted to attain the heights immediately, overnight. And for my first teacher, Haridas, used to say, slowly, slowly. And you know, gradually, gradually. And Baba did the same, so. So he says, everything happens in its own time. The one who's ready for the absolute knowledge will be made somehow to hear of it and follow up on it. I think every story here, every one of us has a story that if you think of the knowledge of the self, this knowledge, as a body of knowledge, it's actually an esoteric body of knowledge. When did it first come into your consciousness? Because most people on the earth, as it is now, never contacted it, except 10th hand, perhaps. And so when did it actually come in? Of course, the most decisive, the time I told you when I met Ram Dass in February of 1970, that was a decisive moment, but things had happened to me before that that were leading up to it. Anyway, he says, so they will. You get to hear about it, and then you follow up on it. He will realize that self-knowledge is the highest of all virtues and also the end of the journey. Do you believe that? That self-knowledge, knowledge of the self, of the true self, and it doesn't mean academic knowledge, although that's part of it. It means experiential knowledge. It means you're in a state of peace and bliss and fulfillment. And he says it's the end of the journey. So then somebody asks, what is the difference between external and internal? External, internal nirvikalpa samadhis. The master said, Ramana said, external samadhi is holding on to the reality while witnessing the world. while reacting to it from within. There's the stillness of a waveless ocean. Internal samadhi involves loss of body consciousness. So this is a distinction yogis always make. There's an inner samadhi and an outer samadhi. The inner samadhi is the ability to meditate deeply. You're no longer, like when you're in deep sleep, you're no longer your personality or your body, are you? You're just in some deep state. So in deep meditation, you're no longer in your normal drama. You're just in a deep state. There's no you, actually, or just a sense of you, but doesn't have a name and form and political party. And you just, that's the deep state of meditation. And then it says, but also there's the external state where you bring that out and you're in a meditative state even while you're moving in the world. What would that be? That would be that you have contact with the self. You don't give away that feeling of self. And you handle everything with equanimity. Devotee, is the loss of body consciousness a requisite to the attainment of sahaja samadhi? He's still asking about all these technical things. Ramana says, what is body consciousness? Analyze it. There must be a body and consciousness limited to it, which together make up body consciousness. These must lie in another consciousness, which is absolute and unaffected. Hold it. That is samadhi. The consciousness that is above your body consciousness. Hold that. It exists when there is no body consciousness because it transcends body consciousness. What does it matter whether body consciousness is lost or retained? Now, this is pure Ramana now. What does it matter? It doesn't matter if you're conscious of your body or not. When lost, it's internal samadhi, and when retained, it's external samadhi. That is all. Ramana always would end intellectual discussions by saying, that is all. This is not a big deal. It's simple. That is all. A sage wrote, he said, be a Vedantin with eyes closed and be a Shaivite with eyes open. The two samadhis. So when you turn within, you're in the formless. When you transcend the mind, there's no thoughts, then it's just pure formlessness. So in that state, you're Vedantin. Nothing but Brahman exists. But when your eyes are open, you see the world. To be a Shaivite means you see it all as divine. It's all God. So that's the state for your waking, moving state. And then when you go into meditation, you can leave it all behind. And I had another quote from Ramana. A devotee said, and this has to do with the debate between Vedanta and everyone else. Vedanta says, there's one truth, and the world is unreal. So the devotee asked him, is the world real or unreal? As the Advaitins say, as the Vedantins say, is the world real or unreal? His answer is brilliant. Ramana says, it is unreal if viewed as apart from the self, and real if viewed as the self. So he includes both Vedanta and Shaivism there. That's, I can't even explain that one. It's just great. And then, let's see. So the Cohen says, the mind does not sink into that state even for a second. And Ramana says, a strong conviction is necessary that I am the self, transcending the mind and phenomena. And this is very strongly reminiscent to me. Baba, there's a sutra in Kashmir Shaivism, in the Shiva Sutras, Vitarka Atma Jnanam. And Baba translated as, conviction is knowledge of the self. You have to have a conviction, I am the self. That's the conviction. As you grow in your practice, you're more and more convinced that the self is the highest good. And when you wander away from it, you suffer intensely. And you only get convinced of that by practice and by suffering intensely, by discovering when you move away from that sweet spot, that's your priority. You have to make that staying with it. So, Vitarka Atmajnanam. And I remember for me, when there was a question which I've talked about many times, when I asked Baba something about the ego and the self, and he said, don't think I'm a sinner or I'm a beggar or a king, that's inflated ego or the diminished ego. Think I am the self. Think I am the self. I am Shiva. I am the self. And somehow that conviction came to me, and I knew that that was the truth when he said that. He says, the Kohn is not going to accept that. He says, nevertheless, the mind proves to be restraint against attempts to quiet it. And Ramana says, always looking for this third force here, he says, what does it matter if the mind is active? You see, people say, oh, my mind's so active. He's saying, it doesn't matter. Let the mind chatter. He says, the self is always the substratum of the mind. So, no big deal. Hold the self. Even during mental activities, even when your mind's chattering, stay with the self. And I found a wonderful quote, because then the next thing, if Cohen wanted to ask it, would be, well, what is the self, right? So Ramana actually asked it. A devotee on another occasion said, the self is formless, how can I concentrate on it? This is brilliant. Listen carefully, this is Ramana at his very best. He's always a great teacher, is making what's difficult simple. He's always making it easy to do and to grasp, not making it harder. A bad teacher will make things more and more difficult, complex, and, you know. So Ramana says, leave the self alone, which you consider intangible. Mind is tangible to you. Hold the mind, and it will do. Just wonderful. So if you don't know where your self is, then just grab your mind. Right now, let's do it for a second. Grab your mind. Sticking your ugly mind is there. Where is it? In your head? Mind is in your head. Just hold it. Hold it as though in your hands, like this, cradling it. Just hold it. Doesn't matter if it's thinking or not. It gets so surprised when you hold it that it shuts up. And before you know it, you connect to you with the self. There's movement of energy and bliss going on. So remember that. If you want to take one thing, I'll be my own editor tonight. Just remember, hold your mind. Forget about the self. Hold your mind, just hold it there, like that. Hold it for me, will you? Hold it for me for a minute. I'll be right back to get it. Just hold it. Lovely. Ramana's filled with these extraordinary... extraordinary insight. Insight. That only a great realizer could give you, you know? It's so beautiful. Anyway. Now, here, continue. This part of the dialogue is fantastic. Cohen says, I cannot go sufficiently deep. And Ramana's reaction to that is very interesting. He says, it's wrong to say so. So he's uttering a tearing thought. I can't do it. It's a tearing thought. And Ramana says, it's wrong to think that way. You're selling yourself short, you're indulging. He says, where are you now if not the self? Where should you go? All that is necessary is the stern belief that you're the self. It's once again, Vitarka Atmajnanam. Know that you're the self. Say rather, don't hold it that way, that I can't go deep enough. Say rather that the other activities throw a veil on you. You see, that's the attitude of the Shiva process. Shiva Prasad says you are the self, and that your anger, your fear, your sadness, your paranoia, your jealousy throws a veil over it. It's a much healthier attitude rather than that I can't get there. And Devotee says, yes, it is so. And Ramana says, that means the conviction is weak. And Devotee says, I understand that the I is only artificial. My attempts at realizing the real I are unavailing because the artificial I, the ego, is brought into action for realizing the other. So he's got all kinds of reasons why he can't get there. Ramana's just saying, just be there. And Ramana says, Viveka Chudamani, which is the crestual discriminator, it's a text, makes it clear that the artificial I, the ego, is a projection, and through it one must look to the true I, the true principle. So use, as Baba told me, the ego becomes healthy if you use it to know the self. In fact, it's discovered that your ego is nothing but, as Baba said, an impulse of the self. Question. Saint Teresa and others saw the image of Madonna animated. It was external. Others see the images of their devotion in their mental sight. So they saw the image of the deity outside, and some see it inside. This is internal. Is there any difference in degree in these two cases? And I can just hear Ramana say, stop. Stop already, please. So Ramana says, both indicate that the person has strongly developed meditation, having visions. Both are good and progressive. There's no difference in degree. So don't worry about that. The one has a conception of divinity and draws mental images and feels them. The other has the conception of divinity in the image and feels it in the image. The feeling is within in both instances. Sweet reasonableness, Ramana. No? Beautiful. All right, now some nice stories. That's enough of the teaching, okay? Just remember this one thing. Hold your mind. I dare you. When you hold your mind, is it hot? Is it cold? Is it sticky? Is it thick or thin? Is it active? Does it weigh a lot? Think about it. So this is S.S. Cohn writing about his experience. His first time he met Ramana. He says, it was then the ashram's custom to honor the newcomer by giving him his first meal in a line directly opposite the Maharshi's seat. After food, someone announced that the Maharshi was coming to the hall. I rushed there. Behind me calmly walked in the tall, impressive figure of the Maharishi with leisurely though firm steps. I was alone in the hall with him. Joy and peace suffused my being. Never before had I such a delightful feeling of purity and well-being at the mere proximity of a man. After a while, I saw him looking at me with large, penetrating eyes, rendered divinely soothing by their childlike innocence. You can put that picture of the old fella. The second one you showed. The iconic one, that one, yeah. I became absorbed in the entrancing personality of this magnificent human magnet, Sri Ramana Bhagavan. It is needless to say, from that day, the ashram became my permanent home. So he got a form of Shaktipat, that he felt such an aura, such a feeling of peace and sweetness. I constructed a hut for my residence near the ashram in March 1936. I hardly stayed in it in the daytime. My mind was wholly fixed on the master. So I spent my days and a part of my nights in the hall where the Maharshi lived and slept. Then I quietly sat and listened to the visitors talk with him and to his answers, which were sometimes translated into English, particularly if the questioner was a foreigner or a North Indian. His answers were fresh and sweet. His influence was all pervasive in his silence, not less than in his speech. I know that feeling that when I first met Baba, I have the feeling, this dude has the secret that I'm looking for. And I would sit and then think, what is that? And it would be palpable, and it would make me feel great in his aura. And I'd think, what is that thing, and how do I get it? And then I thought, well, I got it. I just sit with him. So I decided to spend the rest of my life sitting with him, since it's the best yoga. Anyway, you want to show him, Ramana, sitting? This is him in the way the hall was. He's just sitting there on his couch, and all the people are just soaking up the atmosphere. They didn't give lectures, although if you had a question, he would answer. Usually the answer was always the same, you know, find out who you are. To the serious-minded, Bhagavan was a beacon of light in otherwise impenetrable darkness and a haven of peace. The years 1936 to 38 were very blissful indeed. We could gather around Bhagavan's couch, speak to him intimately as to a beloved father, tell him our troubles without let or hindrance. Bhagavan related to us stories, yielding to transportation of emotions when he depicted a scene of great bhakti or great human tragedies to which he was sensitive in the extreme. Then he shed tears, which he vainly attempted to conceal. So he would get a... Some stories are memorable, like that of Kabir. You know Kabir, the famous poet saint. And so Ramana told the story of Kabir, who had cities, yet he earned his livelihood by weaving, which was his profession. One day while Kabir was working on his loom, a disciple entered in great excitement and said, "Sir, there's a juggler outside who's attracting..." He can turn him down. "Who's attracting large crowds by making his stick stand in the air." Thereupon Kabir, who like all true saints, discouraged the display of jugglery in cities' powers, wanted to shame the man, rushed out with a big ball of thread in his hand and threw it in the air. The ball went up, up and up, unwinding till the whole thread stood stiff in midair. The people, including the juggler, were stunned in amazement, and Bhagavan's eyes acted the amazement, with his hand stood high above his head in the position of Kabir when he threw up the ball. So Bhagavan's like this, you know, showing it like that. This is a miracle story. Head waggled. You have to go like this. The only way to appreciate the story is like this. Wow, 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 wow. Another occasion, Bhagavan recited from memory a poem of a Vaishnava saint in which occurred the words, "Fold me in thy embrace, O Lord. Fold me in thy embrace, O Lord." When the arms of Bhagavan joined in a circle round the vacant air before him, "Fold me in thy embrace, O Lord." His eyes shone with devotional ardor, while his voice shook with stifled sobs, which did not escape our notice. It was fascinating to see him acting the parts he related and be in such exhilarated moods as these. So he's telling the story where, "Fold me," and he's feeling every bit of it. Beautiful. Let's see, here's one. 3 years rolled by. The master used to pass, this is all about his personality. The master used to pass by my hut almost every day. Often he took shelter from the midday sun on my veranda for 2 or 3 minutes, during which I made myself scarce in order not to inconvenience him. Till one day I foolishly placed a chair for his use on the sly, which made him once and for all boycott the veranda. You say, peculiar. You couldn't do anything, you couldn't take any trouble. He'd run away. Despite his full knowledge of our adoration of him, he was extremely sensitive to the slightest trouble which might ensue from him to us, or for that matter to anyone. Thus placing a chair for him or expecting him every day at a fixed hour, he interpreted as interfering with my rest, hence the boycott. And then the writer gives another one from another Western devotee named Major Chadwick. He says, similar thing. In the early days of my stay, 1935-36, I was living in a big room adjoining the ashram storeroom. Here Bhagavan used to visit me. On coming into my room unexpectedly, he would tell me not to disturb myself, but to go on with whatever I was occupied at the time. I would remain seated, carrying on with whatever I was doing at the time. I realize now that this was looked upon as terrible disrespect by the Indian devotees, you know. But it had its reward. If one put oneself out for Bhagwan or appeared in any way disturbed, he would just not come in the future. So you had to act naturally. Like, here's Bhagwan Nityananda walks in, and you're just supposed to be, you know, whatever you're doing. Yeah. He would disturb nobody, so considerate was he. But if one carried on with what one was doing, he would himself take a seat and talk quite naturally, with that formality which usually surrounded him in the hall. I had no idea how lucky I was and how privileged, but certainly appreciated the visits. Like that? Let's see. And a few. This is from Cohen's notes also. A few things he wrote down that Ramana said. He says, think of God. Attachments will gradually drop away. If you wait till all desires disappear before starting your devotion and prayer, you'll have to wait for a very long time indeed. So don't wait for till you're purified to do your sadhana. Do your sadhana now. That which comes and goes, rises and sets, is born and dies, is the ego. That which always abides, never changes, and is devoid of qualities, is the self. So I would say, if you were to ask yourself, what has it been there throughout your whole life? A lot of things have changed. You may have changed your where you live, you may have changed your family, you may have changed your partner, you may have changed your country. Many things have changed. You may have changed your ideas. You might have been a left-winger, and then a right-winger, and then a left-winger, and then a right-winger. You might have changed your philosophy. Many things change, but there is something that ties it all together. And so you always say, these happened to me. It's that sense of self, which is so subtle it's hard to grasp, but that is what abides, and that is the self. That's a clues to connect to that. He says, pain and pleasure are to the ego, which is itself imagined. When the ego disappears through a constant inquiry into its nature, the illusion of pleasure and pain also disappears, and the self alone remains. Here's another one. We are so accustomed to objectivity, to being external, that we've lost the knowledge of ourself simply because the self cannot be objectified. Western approach is always to study something as an object. But what is the thing that can never be an object? The thing that can never be an object is your own self. So look at it inside you. What is it that is always the most subjective of part of you, the part that never is an object? That's a clue to the self. We are the self, yet we ask how to know the self. And the last one before we meditate. You like these? Let me have a sip. My phlegm seems better, no? You think? I'm less, because I have this nice drink. Yes.
The elixir of
Cleveland. What?
The elixir of
Well, it's still something, but. Bhagavan Ramana says, oh, I'll do two of them. This is in those days, of course, the movies were new. And he used the movies as a metaphor, like Bhagavan Nityananda used local village metaphors, so he used the cinema as a metaphor. He says, Bhagavan says, the real is ever present, like the screen on which the cinematographic pictures move. So the screen is the self is the screen, and the world is the images, because they come and go. Screen's always there. While the picture appears on it, the screen remains invisible. That's a really good analogy, isn't it? Stop the picture and the screen will become clear. All thoughts and events are merely pictures moving on the screen of pure consciousness, which alone is real. In a cinema show, you can see pictures only in a very dim light or in darkness. When all the lights are switched on, the pictures disappear. It's another way of looking at it. So also in the floodlight of the supreme Atman, all objects disappear. And finally, then we'll meditate for 10 minutes. Meditation includes mind control, the subtle watchfulness against intruding thoughts. In the beginning, efforts for control are greater than for actual meditation. But in due course, meditation wins and becomes effortless. So when you begin meditation, it's a struggle, you're fighting the mind, and you're quite aware of it. In fact, you can feel a despair, a hopelessness. How will I ever control this mind? But as you work with it, and you get in touch with the substratum of the self, and as you understand the inner more and more, you learn how to rest in that place of the self. So let's meditate now. We'll meditate for 10 minutes. And you can take any of those thoughts that Ramana offered as a way to meditate. You can start by holding your mind. Grab hold of your mind. See if you can do that. And of course, if that's difficult, then merely repeating the mantra, Om Namah Shivaya, is a good way to still the mind. So once again, with great love and respect, I welcome you all with all my heart. Satguru Nath Maharaj Ki Jai. Let's meditate for 10 minutes.